Okay, today we are talking to Paul Martin, an expert in the development of chemical processes. 25 years ago, or even longer than 25 years ago, he actually started working in ground and wastewater treatment and contaminated sites remediation, but that's not what we are talking to him about today. Paul worked a lot in the design and construction of pilot plants, larger demonstration plants, and then the upscaling of those plants to commercialization in the petroleum and natural gas industry. He has also become quite an expert in all matters regarding hydrogen, and that's actually how I came across Paul, because he was a speaker in one of the ALGAs, so the Australian Land and Groundwater Association talks that are put on regularly. And he was there as an expert regarding hydrogen and what role hydrogen can play and will play in our future. James and I, we went way over time. I'm trying to keep these interviews to 30 minutes, which isn't always easy. In post-processing, I just couldn't get myself to cutting a lot of the talk out. So I decided to turn this interview into a two-part series, if you want to call it. In the first part, we particularly focus on energy efficiencies regarding hydrogen, how to turn electricity into hydrogen, how to prepare it for export, and whether that actually makes economical and energetic sense. In part two, Paul will explain how, in his opinion, hydrogen should be used, and he gives us a particular focus on Australia, how high voltage direct current cables come into this game, how we best store hydrogen, and most importantly, how, in his eyes, we can decarbonize our lives. Paul mentions a few articles he has written, and I have put all these links into the show notes. So here is our chat with Paul Martin, all the way from Toronto in Canada.
Oh, yeah, I'm ready. James, are you ready?
Should I talk like as if this is it?
I'm not telling you whether I'm recording or not. Because
I know we're recording. I never know on these things. I'm like, am I in podcast mode or not?
You should never be. See, this is the thing. You should never be in podcast mode. It should just be you.
I have to switch over to my pod persona. You're going to leave all this in, aren't you?
No. You are already in the car?
I've had to go into the car because it's too loud inside. I couldn't find a good quiet spot.
Ah, okay. So your car is your recording studio.
This is my recording studio. I think that the acoustics might be all right in here, actually.
Okay.
We have to really stop chatting because Paul is waiting to be let in here.
I let him in, okay?
G'day, Paul.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Good. I like your office there.
It's a surreal place. So we've got a car bonnet hanging from the ceiling there and emerging from the wall. We've got René Magritte paintings. And, of course, we've got a photo of a Banksy here that appeared in Toronto. And it's a guy in a 1930s suit. And he's wearing a cardboard sign around his neck that says, "Will work for idiots."
That's great.
Paul, you work for yourself. You realize that, right?
I do. I work for myself, but I am happy now to have clients, and clients are great because they're far easier to replace than bad bosses are.
You know, the old saying is this one of my favorites, where they say the client is always right. I'm like, whoever came up with that? That's just so not true.
If the client was always right, then I'd be out of business.
Yeah, they wouldn't need us.
I'm much happier as an independent consultant than I ever was as an employee.
And how long have you been out on your own, Paul?
I really rewoke my consulting business about 3 years ago, and about 2 years ago, I incorporated it, started taking it seriously as a way to, you know, earn a living.
Yeah, good on you, mate. I mean, we haven't met each other before, but I founded Four Pillars, and it's been running now for about 7 years or so. So I've got a huge amount of respect for anyone who steps out and does it on their own, because it's not easy, mate. So good on you.
Yeah, well, you know what? Yeah, like I said, it's been a blast. It's been a pleasant surprise how well it's gone. I figured there'd be awesome beer money in it for me, and no, it's more like a living.
Absolutely, no, that's fantastic.
And I'm having a riot. And my website
Fantastic.
makes it very clear that my product is no bullshit. That if you want somebody to, blow smoke about your great new idea and how great it is, that you've come to the wrong place.
I don't know where I read it. Was it one of your articles or is it your website where you say, hey, this article was written by a human and
Oh
human
yeah,
means.
all my articles say that. They say this article has been written by a human, and humans are prone to mistakes. So if there's a mistake in there, don't be surprised. Let me know. I'll be happy to correct it because I care more about getting the issue correct than about being right personally. But then what I say in the disclaimer is, if, however, the reason that you're upset with me is that I've just taken a dump on your pet idea, then contact my employer, Spitfire Research, which will be happy to tell you to piss off and write your own articles.
Yeah,
I like
I read that and I thought, I need to interview this guy.
that.
Yeah, I came across you when you were giving an ALGA talk here in Australia. It was one of the most entertaining ALGA talks I have ever listened to. I love them, everybody. I always promote them. They are fantastic. You were the third speaker. The first speaker was from Victoria.
I remember that talk.
Yeah, from the government. What was her name? I wrote it down here somewhere. She had a beautiful, like truly beautiful presentation. It was optically fantastic. She was well spoken, and yet for 15 minutes, I'm sitting here. It's like, what is this? Was a political speech. There was nothing in it. Then comes the CEO of a project where they are trying to turn Victorian coal into green hydrogen,
With
and.
carbon capture and storage at some future date,
Yes.
which is unknown. Yes, I remember this very well. One of the
Um,
worst
and
projects I've ever heard of. Yes.
yeah, but you and then you come on board, and I'm sitting there, I'm slightly nodding off after these two already, right? And then you come on board and you start speaking, and your title was already, separating hopium, so separating hope from reality. I'm like, oh, hang on a minute, I need to listen. And for the next 15 minutes, you presented such wonderful slides and wonderful data, telling them pretty much that, guys, your project is a non-starter. It's just not gonna work economically. It's different when you have the Victorian government behind you, who is trying to run some sort of advertising or public relations campaign, which it appeared to me that this is what's happening here. But not if you're ever trying to be commercially viable or energetically viable, or let's face it, we are all trying to decarbonize. It doesn't seem to work. So you are a chemical process development expert. I looked that one up. You are never tired of pointing out the challenges we face by using hydrogen as the way out of our carbon problem.
The problem with hydrogen in simple terms is that it's the answer to the wrong question. So when you ask yourself the wrong question, you get hydrogen as an answer. So the wrong question is, we can't burn fossils anymore. What else can we burn? And the answer to that question is a very limited number of things, and hydrogen being one of them, hydrogen-derived molecules being another. But the right question we should be asking is, we can't burn fossils anymore. How do we provide the energy services that we used to provide by burning fossils? And the answer to that question is almost never hydrogen. So we've got the people who want to keep burning things looking for something else to burn. And that's conceptually simple and nonsense. It's economic nonsense. It's nonsense from a physics and thermodynamics perspective. And when you look at it in detail, as my colleague Joanne Whitmore and I just did recently in relation to a project in Quebec, where they're promoting the notion of taking $18 per gigajoule electricity, hydroelectricity in Quebec, plus wind and solar that they make themselves, and turning that into $80 to $90 a gigajoule methane, which is heat. On the face of it, that's insane. Why would you ever do that? That's crazy. And so it begs the question, what are these people doing? They can't fail to notice that they're converting $18 a gigajoule electricity into heat that costs four times as much. They can't fail to notice that,
Well,
right? So there
see,
must be
this
something
is.
else going on, and it's clear what's going on. This is a predatory delay strategy that exists either to harvest subsidies on the part of the project proponents, or to extend the social license of burning fossil fuels on the part of the consumer in this case, which is a natural gas utility in Quebec. So it's one hand washes the other, and everybody's happy except for the consumer and except for the atmosphere. The atmosphere is not fooled.
I ever since you spoke at Alga, I'm a little bit of a of I hate the word skeptic, but because it's been hijacked by the wrong people, but
Sure.
I'm certainly skeptical about the future of hydrogen when after I listened to you. And then in comes, Fortescue Metals and Andrew Forrest, who is most definitely a smart guy.
Oh,
You
yeah.
don't create what he has created if you don't know your way around energy. That's for sure. And he comes on and he jumps onto this hydrogen bandwagon in a massive way. He gets his buddies to invest, and he invests and gets taxpayers' money, I assume, to invest into his hydrogen. Where and Australia follows because, oh, we have so much sun, yeah, we know that, and we have so much wind, yeah, we know that. We are also bloody far away from everything, and
Yeah.
that's where people seem to then stop. Well, let's turn the energy that we have and let's turn it into hydrogen by splitting water into hydrogen and oxygen, and then we just ship it off like we do with natural gas. We ship it off to Germany or Japan.
Yeah, so it's only
Sounds
parts.
simple.
So it's only part three of that three-part thing that I find a problem with. So,
Yes. Okay, this is where I want to drill into a little bit. So
sure.
let's say we have 1,000 energy units. We don't have to talk kilowatt hours or whatever, joule mil.
Whatever. Yeah.
Let's even say they are completely green. So we have made it with completely renewable energy. We have 1,000 energy units. So now we want to transport these energy units using hydrogen to, say, Japan. Tell me how that works and tell me the cycle efficiency.
Yeah, it doesn't. It works very badly, regardless which way you do it. I have an article that's called The Myth of Hydrogen for Export. The energy efficiency of all of these strategies varies from bad to terrible. The ones that are okay, that are, tolerable, there are still the efficiencies are really bad. And the reason that they're worse still is that their capital investment requirements are extremely high. So somebody's got to pay for that capital, which is wasting all that energy. When you add that up, the economic efficiency or the cost per delivered kilowatt hour in Japan or South Korea is absurd. And basically what's going on there is that you have people in South Korea and Japan, as an example, very energy hungry nations that, are not good friends with their nearest land neighbors. HVDC cables scare them because they're worried that their land neighbors will just step on the cable every time they say something wrong. So they want to be able to import energy from country X instead of country Y if the politics change, and they have good reasons for all of that. The problem is that if they were to commit to a future where they keep importing energy in the form of chemical energy made from electricity, their major industries are dead. Anything that uses a significant amount of energy will be dead because their market competitors will be have an energy cost of a fifth of what theirs is or less. What troubles me is the notion that you're going to replicate the fossil fuel energy system of import addicted nations like Japan and South Korea, and that they're going to somehow manage to still have heavy industry. That notion is just absurd. There is no economic justification for that. And anyone who's given it 5 minutes of thought with a calculator and Google and a basic knowledge of thermodynamics should know that.
So it sounds like, I guess, yeah, the argument again, which probably hits home pretty well on a kind of a layman who doesn't really get into the detail of this, is that the claim is essentially that the hydrogen that they or the ammonia that they would be burning has been produced as a net neutral carbon emitter, I guess, in terms of the production of that fuel.
Okay,
But what is being
say
lost,
it is, say it is.
but it
Go
sounds like
ahead.
what's being lost in the discussion is the efficiency piece, which is about the huge reduction in efficiency and the huge energy cost in converting one form to another. And that's what's not being captured. So technically it might be true, but
So there's two
yeah.
things. Inefficiency acts as a multiplier on cost, okay? And that's the thing that kills it, but it also acts as a multiplier on emissions. Because wind and solar are not free of greenhouse gas emissions.
Let me go back to my 1,000 energy units of green energy, which is basically electricity. We know how to create electricity green these days very well. So we have 1,000 energy units. I now want to turn these 1,000 energy units into hydrogen ready for transport. Talk me through that chemical and physical process. process
Okay, so
percentages.
let's start with 1,000 kilowatt hours of electricity, wind and solar. We feed that to an electrolyzer, and in terms of lower heating value, which is materially important if we want to make electricity at the other end, the world's best electrolyzer that you can buy, you can't afford this electrolyzer, by the way, it's way too expensive. Best one you can buy, 70% efficient on a lower heating value basis. So we've taken 1,000 kilowatt hours of pure thermodynamic work, electricity, and we've turned it into 700 kilowatt hours of a proxy for heat.
So,
We've thrown away way more than 30%. We have thrown away 30% of the energy. We've thrown away 70% of the exergy. Exergy is the potential to do work again at the other end. Okay? So a unit of electricity is one unit of exergy, basically. So one unit of electricity can be made into one unit of mechanical energy or near enough. You know, you can put it into a motor, you can put it into an LED light, you can put it into an electric heater, and efficiencies are all high. But if you have heat in the form of a chemical like hydrogen, your ability to convert that back into thermodynamic work is limited by the efficiency of either a fuel cell or Carnot's efficiency if you're going to feed it to a power plant. And those efficiencies are bad. Okay. So a world best class electrolyzer does about 70% efficiency. So we take 1,000 kilowatt hours of electricity, we make 700 of heat. Now we have to store it. So we're going to rob another 10%.
How do we store it? So
Okay.
we compress it and cool
We have
it.
to compress it. Yeah. I mean, we're going to put it. No, not cooling it. If you want to make a liquid out of it, you're going to throw away 30 plus percent. Okay. But we're just going to compress it to put it into a local tank somewhere so that we can store it for a minute, you know, or an hour so that we can level out the output of this electrolyzer and feed a plant with it. Okay. Now we feed it immediately into a fuel cell or a combined cycle gas turbine power plant. Now, you can't afford a fuel cell that's 60% efficient, but you can buy one. A combined cycle power plant happens to be about the same, about 60% LHV efficient. Multiply those three by one another, 70 times 90 times 60%, you get 37%. In other words, buy 3 kilowatt hours, get one back. But we haven't transported anything. We haven't distributed anything. We haven't had any grid losses to a remote electrolyzer or any transport losses of hydrogen through a pipeline or anything. Let's say we were close enough that we could build a pipeline. That would be our best option. Not Australia, though. Okay. You guys are way too far away to make a pipeline viable. So you're not going to be shipping by pipeline from Australia. However, you could feasibly build a pipeline from, say, Qatar or Saudi Arabia or somewhere like that to Sicily. You could build a pipeline. Pipelines, they're pretty efficient and they're very cost efficient. So if you needed hydrogen at the other end and you wanted to make hydrogen in Morocco and use it in Spain, you wouldn't move electricity there and then make the electricity into hydrogen. You would move hydrogen with a pipeline for sure. Okay. But that assumes that you need hydrogen for its properties as a molecule. If you're going to burn it in a power plant, you would be insane to make hydrogen, put it into a pipeline, and then turn it back into electricity in a power plant. That would be crazy. You would never do that. You would move electricity from Morocco to Spain and use the electricity in Spain. Because that huge loss is not recovered in any benefit from this putative storage. Now, let's talk specifically about Australia. You don't have pipelines as an option. So your options are make a liquid, lose 30, another 30%, okay? Then transport losses of this ultra cryogenic liquid as it boils off on this trip across the ocean, convert it back to vapor, and then you have to feed it to a power plant. The losses are absurd. And it's the same with making ammonia, making methanol, making liquid organic hydrogen carriers. This is where you hydrogenate a molecule like toluene to make methyl cyclohexane, and then you dehydrogenate it at the other end. All of these strategies, they have the same problem. You put in energy in order to make something else. There's a loss associated with that, generally in the form of heat. That heat is worthless because it's being made where there's already heat in excess, right? It's the place where you have the excess electricity already. And then you have to put energy back in again to deconvert that thing back into hydrogen. And those are, you know, two sides of the same coin. You can't get around it. There's no thermodynamic trick here. every one of them that reduces storage pressure or storage volume and makes transport feasible has these same problems. It wastes energy and it wastes capital, and it requires energy at destination, which makes the cycle efficiency even worse. And the dumbest among these, I dare not say that because there's so many spectacularly dumb ideas out there, but probably the dumbest of them is making methane out of hydrogen. And 99% of the world's hydrogen today is made by taking something like methane and reacting it with water to make hydrogen. Okay. And the CO2 that's produced is vented. It's not captured. Nothing's done with it. And so we have people that want to do the reverse using electricity, which is extremely valuable energy. And then they want to liquefy it to turn it into LNG and ship it. The energetics of that are so abysmal. Like I said before, running the numbers, the economics are terrible, but the energetics are so abysmal.
And so just to go back to what you were saying before, so what's the number at the end? So that process you just talked about where we had the 1,000 kilowatt hours of electricity.
Electrolysis, storage, and making electricity again, that's 370. Okay. But if you add any other step to make it more transportable, like making a liquid, making ammonia, making methanol, making LOHCs, it's more like 10, like 100 to 200.
Oof.
Yeah,
Okay.
right.
But the thing is, on top of it's not just 100 to 200. It's not just that you're paying five times as much per unit of electricity. You're paying way more than that because you got to pay for an ammonia plant. You got to pay for a ship. You got to pay for a storage depot here, a storage depot there, regasification equipment. All of this capital equipment adds money, and people are going, well, geez, batteries are expensive. Well, they're not that expensive. So what's it really about? It's about JERA, for instance, wanting to blend a little bit of ammonia with the coal that they put into their coal-fired power plants in order to extend the social license to keep burning coal. It has nothing to do with decarbonization. Japan and South Korea, their decarbonization strategy is pretend to decarbonize for as long as possible and as long as we can get away with it, and don't actually decarbonize. And how do you know that? Are they plunking wind turbines and solar panels all over those countries? No, they're not. Are they building nuclear power plants? Nope, they're not doing any of that. If they were, I might go, okay, well, maybe they're looking for hydrogen from Australia to make up the last 10%, and maybe they can afford that. Or maybe they're going to import ammonia for fertilizer, or they're going to import, direct reduced iron or other products in order to green up their industry. That would seem logical, but they're not doing that. They know they're not decarbonizing. They're pretending to decarbonize. And the reason that they're going to say that they can't decarbonize is that you guys can't do it cheap enough. When you look at it in detail, the only thing that can be about is subsidy harvesting. So they're taking subsidies for making green electricity, and then subsidies for making hydrogen, and then subsidies for making a green fuel, and then they're exporting it to somebody who gives them a subsidy for a green fuel. And it's the subsidies stacked on top of subsidies on top of one another that gives the projects the illusion of economic viability. And even then, it's questionable. So it's not a form of storage. It's really not much of anything. It's hyperbole. It's hopium, as I said. It's the drug that people make out of hopium in order to separate other people from their money.
Okay, sorry for the interruption, but that was the end of part one, hence the boxing bell sound. I hope you got that. Before we let you go, let me just quickly recap what we just heard because it's really important. And so here we go. If you have 1,000 kilowatt hours of energy units, say electricity, that you created in Australia, and you turn that into hydrogen and immediately back into electricity, and you use the most expensive and most efficient devices currently available anywhere, when you turn that back into electricity, you end up with 370 energy units. On the way, you create a whole bunch of greenhouse gases, and when you try and capture them with carbon capture, you add to the losses. If in any way you try to transport that hydrogen that you just created through whatever means, you add to the energy overhead. On top of it, since hydrogen is such a small molecule, you also have quite significant losses on the way. You try and mix the hydrogen with, say, methane, so you can use the existing infrastructure. You add to the overhead, and energy losses add up on both ends. It's the same with ammonia. If you add all those losses up, you end up between 100 and 200 energy units at the other end. So create 10 ship transport and then sell one or two to Japan or Germany or whoever. I hope I'm not the only one who thinks that there is not really a future in this for Australia. But not all is lost, of course. In part two, Paul will describe how, in his opinion, hydrogen has a big future and how Australia can very much be benefiting from its vast solar and wind resources. So, see you in part two.